Ladies and gentlemen, join us now for Radio Lillooet's special presentation of Jacob Abbott's Genghis Khan.
Chapter 22 of The History of Genghis Khan. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Dion Jines, Salt Lake City, Utah. The History of Genghis Khan by Jacob Abbott. Chapter 22, Victorious Campaigns, 1220 to 1221. After this, Genghis Khan went on successfully for several years, extending his conquests over all the western part of Central Asia, while the generals whom he had left at home were extending his dominions in the same manner in the eastern portion. He overran nearly all of Persia, went entirely around the Caspian Sea, and even approached the confines of India. In this expedition toward India, he was in pursuit of Jalaluddin. Immediately after the death of his father, Jalaluddin had done all in his power to raise an army and carry on the war against Genghis Khan. He met with a great deal of embarrassment and difficulty at first, on account of the plots and conspiracies which his grandmother had organized in favor of his brother Kothboddin, and the dissensions among his people to which they gave rise. At last, in the course of a year, he succeeded in some measure in healing this breach and in raising an army. And though he was not strong enough to fight the Mongols in a general battle, he hung about them in their march and harassed them in various ways, so as to impede their operations very essentially. Genghis Khan, from time to time, sent off detachments from his army to take him. He was often defeated in the engagements which ensued, but he always succeeded in saving himself and in keeping together a portion of his men, and thus he maintained himself in the field, though he was growing weaker and weaker all the time. At last he became completely discouraged, and after signal defeat, which he met with from a detachment which had been sent against him by Genghis Khan, he went, with the few troops that remained together, to a strong fortress among the mountains, and told the governor that it seemed to him useless to continue the struggle any longer, and that he had come to shut himself up in the fortress and abandon the contest in despair. The governor, however, told him that it was not right for a prince, the descendant of ancestors so illustrious as his, and the inheritor of so resplendent a crown, to yield to discouragement and despondency on account of the reverses of fortune. He advised him again to take the field, and to raise a new army, and continue the contest to the end. Jalaluddin determined to follow this advice, and after a brief period of repose at the castle, he again took the field. He made great exertions, and finally succeeded in getting together about 20,000 men. This was a small force, it is true, compared with the numbers of the enemy, but it was sufficient, if well managed, to enable the prince to undertake operations of considerable importance, and Jalaluddin began to feel somewhat encouraged again. With his 20,000 men, he gained one or two victories, too, which encouraged him still more. In one of these cases, he defeated rather a singular stratagem which the Mongol general contrived. It seems that the Mongol detachment, which was sent out in this instance against Jalaluddin, was not strong enough, and the general, in order to make Jalaluddin believe that his force was greater than it really was, ordered all the felt caps and cloaks that there were in the army to be stuffed with straw, and placed on the horses and camels of the baggage, in order to give the appearance of a second line of reserve in the rear of the line of real soldiers. This was to induce Jalaluddin to surrender without fighting. But in some way or other, Jalaluddin detected the deceit, and instead of surrendering, fought the Mongols with great vigor and defeated them. he gained a very decided victory, and perhaps this might have been the beginning of a change of fortune for him if, unfortunately, his generals had not quarreled about the division of the spoil. There was a beautiful Arabian horse, which two of his leading generals desired to possess, and each claimed it. The dispute became at last so violent that one of the generals struck the other in his face with the lash of his whip. Upon this, the feud became a deadly one. Both parties appealed to Jalaloddin. He did not wish to make either general an enemy by deciding in favor of the other, and so he tried to compromise the matter. He did not succeed in doing this, and one of the generals, mortally offended, went off in the night, taking with him all that portion of the troops which was under his command. Jalaloddin did everything in his power to bring the disaffected general back again, but before he could accomplish this purpose, Genghis Khan came up with a large force between the two parties and prevented their effecting a junction. Jalaloddin had now no alternative but to retreat. Genghis Khan followed him, and it was in this way that, after a time, both the armies reached the banks of the Indus on the borders of India. Jalaloddin, being closely pursued, took his position in a narrow defile near the bank of the river, and here a great battle was fought among the rocks and precipices. Jalaloddin, it is said, had only 30,000 men at his command, while Genghis Khan was at the head of an army of 300,000. The numbers in both cases are probably greatly exaggerated, but the proportion may perhaps be true. It was only a small portion of the Mongol army that could get into the defile where the Sultan's troops had posted themselves, and so desperately did the latter fight that it is said they killed 20,000 of the Mongols before they gave in. In fact, they fought like wild beasts, with desperate and unremitting fury, all day long. Toward night, it became evident to Jalaloddin that it was all over with him. A large portion of his followers were killed. Some had made their escape across the river, though many of those who sought to do so were drowned in the attempt. The rest of his men were completely exhausted and discouraged, and wholly unable to renew the contest on the following day. Jalaloddin had exposed himself very freely in the fight, in hopes, perhaps, that he should be killed. But Genghis Khan had given positive orders that he should be taken alive. He had even appointed two of his generals to watch carefully and to see that no person should, under any circumstances, kill him. He wished to take him alive in order to lead him through the country a prisoner and exhibit him to his former subjects as a trophy of his victory, just as he had done and was still doing with the old Queen Khatun, his grandmother. But Jalaloddin was determined that his conqueror should not enjoy this pleasure. He resolved to attempt to save himself by swimming the river. He accordingly went first, breathless and covered with dust and blood from the fight, to take a hurried leave of his mother, his wives, and his children, who, as was customary in those countries and times, had accompanied him in his campaign. He found them in his tent, full of anxiety and terror. He took leave of them with much sorrow and many tears, trying to comfort them with the hope that they should meet again in happier times. Then he took off his armor and his arms, in order that he might not be impeded in crossing the river, reserving, however, his sword and bow and a quiver full of arrows. He then mounted a fresh horse and rode toward the river. When he reached the bank of the river, the horse found the current so rapid and the agitation of the water so great that he was very unwilling to advance. But Jalaloddin spurred him in. Indeed, there was no time to be lost, for scarcely had he reached the shore when Genghis Khan himself and a party of Mongols appeared in view, advancing to seize him. They stopped on the bank when they saw Jalaloddin ride into the water among the rocks and whirlpools. They did not dare to follow him, but they remained at the waterside to see how his perilous adventure would end. As soon as Jalaloddin found that he was out of their reach, he stopped at a place where his horse found a foothold, and turned round toward his pursuers with looks of hatred and defiance. He then drew his bow and began to shoot at them with his arrows, and he continued to shoot until all the arrows in his quiver were exhausted. Some of the more daring of the Mongols proposed to Genghis Khan that they should swim out and try to take him, but Genghis Khan would not allow them to go. He said the attempt would be useless. "You can do nothing at all with him," said he. "A man of such cool and determined bravery as that will defy and defeat all your attempts. Any father might be proud to have such a son, and any son proud to be descended from such a father." When his arrows were all expended, Jalaloddin took to the river again, and his horse, after a series of most desperate struggles among the whirlpools and eddies, and the boiling surges which swept around the rocks, succeeded at length in carrying his master over. The progress of the horse was watched with great interest by Genghis Khan and his party from the shore as long as they could see him. As soon as Jalaloddin landed and had recovered a little from the fatigue and excitement of the passage, he began to look around him and to consider what was next to be done. He found himself entirely alone in a wild and solitary place, which he had reason to fear was infested with tigers and other ferocious beasts of prey, such as haunt the jungles in India. Night was coming on, too, and there were no signs of any habitations or of any shelter. So he fastened his horse at the foot of a tree and climbed up himself among the branches, and in this way passed the night. The next morning he came down and began to walk along the bank of the river to see what he could find. He was in a state of great anxiety and distress. Suddenly, to his great relief and joy, he came upon a small troop of soldiers, accompanied by some officers, who had escaped across the river from the battle as he had done. Three of these officers were his particular friends, and he was overjoyed to see them. They had made their way across the river in a boat, which they had found upon the bank at the beginning of the defeat of the army. They had spent the whole night in the boat, being in great danger from the shoals and shelving rocks and from the impetuosity of the current. Finally, toward morning, they had landed, not far from the place where Jalaloddin found them. Not long after this, he came upon a troop of 300 horsemen who had escaped by swimming the river at a place where the water was more smooth, at some distance below. These men told him that about 6 miles farther down the stream there was a body of about 4,000 men who had made their escape in a similar manner. On assembling these men, Jalaloddin found himself once more at the head of a considerable force. The immediate wants of his men were, however, extremely pressing, for they were all wholly destitute of food and of every other necessary, and Jalaloddin would have been greatly embarrassed to provide for them had it not been for the thoughtfulness and fidelity of one of the officers of his household on the other side of the river. This officer's name was Jamalarazad. As soon as he found that his master had crossed the river, knowing, too, that a great number of the troops had attempted to cross besides, and that, in all probability, many of them had succeeded in reaching the other bank, who would all be greatly in want of provisions and stores the next morning, he went to work at once during the night and loaded a very large boat with provisions, arms, money, and stuff to make clothing for the soldiers. He succeeded in getting off in this boat before his plan was discovered by the Mongols, and in the course of the next morning he reached the opposite bank with it, and thus furnished to Jalaloddin an abundant provision for his immediate necessities. Jalaloddin was so much pleased with the conduct of Jamalarazad in this affair that he appointed him at once to a very high and responsible office in his service, and gave him a new title of honor. In the meantime, Genghis Khan, on the other side of the river, took possession the next morning of Jalaloddin's camp. Of course, the family of the Sultan fell into his hands. The emperor ordered all the males to be killed, but he reserved the women for a different fate. Among the persons killed was a boy about 8 years old, Jalaloddin's oldest son. Jalaloddin had ordered his treasure to be sunk in the river, intending probably to come back and recover it at some future time. But Genghis Khan found out in some way where it was sunk, and he sent divers down for it, and thus obtained possession of it as a part of his booty. After this, Jalaloddin remained 5 or 6 years in India, where he joined himself and his army with some of the princes of that country, and fought many campaigns there. At length, when a favorable opportunity occurred, he came back to his own country, and fought some time longer against the Mongols there, but he never succeeded in gaining possession of any substantial power. Genghis Khan continued after this for 2 or 3 years in the Mohammedan countries of the western part of Asia, and extended his conquest there in every direction. It is not necessary to follow his movements in detail. It would only be a repetition of the same tale of rapine, plunder, murder, and devastation. Sometimes a city would surrender at once when the conqueror approached the gates, by sending out a deputation of the magistrates and other principal inhabitants with the keys of the city and with magnificent presents in hopes to appease him. And they usually so far succeeded in this as to put the Mongol soldiery in good humor, so that they would content themselves with ransacking and plundering the place, leaving the inhabitants alive. At other times the town would attempt to resist. The Mongols would then build engines to batter down the walls and to hurl great stones over among the besieged. In many instances there was great difficulty in obtaining a sufficient supply of stones, on account of the alluvial character of the ground on which the city stood. In such cases, after the stones found near were exhausted, the besiegers would cut down great trees from the avenues leading to the town, or from the forests near, and, sawing the trunk up into short lengths, would use the immense blocks thus formed as ammunition for the engines. These great logs of heavy wood, when thrown over the walls, were capable of doing almost as much execution as the stones, though compared with a modern bombshell, a monstrous ball of iron, which, after flying 4 or 5 miles from the battery, leaving on its way a fiery train through the air, descends into a town and bursts into 1,000 fragments, which fly like iron hail in every direction around. They were very harmless missiles. In sawing up the trunks of the trees into logs, and in bringing stones for the engines, the Mongols employed the prisoners, whom they had taken in war and made slaves of. The amount of work of this kind, which was to be done at some of the sieges, was very great. It is said that at the siege of Nishabur, a town whose inhabitants greatly offended Genghis Khan by secretly sending arms, provisions, and money to Jalaloddin, after they had once surrendered to the Mongols and pretended to be friendly to them, the army of the Mongols employed 1,200 of these engines, all of which were made at a town at some distance from the place besieged, and were then transported in parts by the slaves, and put together by them under the walls. While the slaves were employed in works of this kind, they were sometimes protected by wooden shields covered with rawhides, which were carried before them by other slaves, to keep off and extinguish the fiery darts and arrows which were shot at them from the wall. Sometimes, too, the places where the engines were set up were protected by wooden bulwarks, which, together with the framework itself of the engines, were covered with raw hides to prevent their being set on fire by the enemy. The number of raw hides required for this purpose was immense, and to obtain them the Mongols slaughtered vast herds of horses and cattle, which they plundered from the enemy. In order to embarrass the enemy in respect to ammunition for their engines, the people of a town, when they heard that the Mongols were coming, used to turn out sometimes in mass several days before, and gather up all the stones they could find, and throw them into the river, or otherwise put them out of the way. In some cases, the towns that were threatened, as has already been said, did not attempt to resist, but submitted at once, and cast themselves on the mercy of the conqueror. In such cases, the Mongol generals usually spared the lives of the inhabitants, though they plundered their property. It sometimes happened, too, that after attempting to defend themselves for some time, the garrison would become discouraged, and then would attempt to make some terms or conditions with the conqueror before they surrendered. In these cases, however, the terms which the Mongols insisted upon were often so hard that, rather than yield to them, the garrison would go on fighting to the end. In one instance, there lived a town that was to be assailed a certain sheik or prince named Kubru, who was a man of very exalted character as well as of high distinction. The Mongol general whom Genghis Khan had commissioned to take the town was his third son, Oktay. Oktay had heard of the fame of the sheik and had conceived a very high respect for him. So he sent a herald to the wall with a passport for the sheik and for 10 other persons, such as he should choose, giving him free permission to leave the town and go wherever he pleased. But the sheik declined the offer. Then Oktay sent in another passport with permission to the sheik to take 1,000 men with him. But he still refused. He could not accept Oktay's bounty, he said, unless it was extended to all the Mohammedans in the town. He was obliged to take his lot with the rest, for he was bound to his people by ties too strong to be easily sundered. So the siege went on, and at the end of it, when the town was carried, the sheik was slain with the rest in the streets, where he stood his ground to the last, fighting like a lion. All the Mohammedan chieftains, however, did not possess so noble a spirit as this. One chieftain, when he found that the Mongols were coming, caused himself to be let down with ropes from the wall in the night, and so made his escape, leaving the town and the garrison to their fate. The garrisons of the towns, knowing that they had little mercy to expect from their terrible enemies, fought often very desperately to the last, as they would have done against beasts of prey. They would suddenly open the gates and rush out in large bands, provided with combustibles of all kinds and torches, with which they would set fire to the engines of the besiegers, and then get back again within the walls before the Mongols could recover sufficiently from the alarm and confusion to intercept them. In this manner they destroyed a great many of the engines and killed vast numbers of men. Still the Mongols would persevere, and sooner or later the place was sure to fall. Then, when the inhabitants found that all hope was over, they had become so desperate in their hatred of their foes that they would sometimes set the town on fire with their own hands and throw themselves and their wives and children into the flames rather than fall into the hands of their infuriated enemies. The cruelties which the Mongols perpetrated upon their unhappy victims when, after a long resistance, they finally gained possession of a town were indeed dreadful. They usually ordered all the people to come out to an open space on the plain, and there, after taking out all the young and able-bodied men who could be made useful in bringing stones and setting up engines and other such labors, and also all the young and beautiful women to be divided among the army or sold as slaves, they would put the rest together in a mass and kill them all by shooting at them with arrows, just as if they had been beasts surrounded in a chase, excepting that the excitement and pleasure of shooting into such a mass of human victims, and of hearing the shrieks and cries of their terror, was probably infinitely greater to their brutal murderers than if it had been a herd of lions, tigers, and wolves that they were destroying. It is said by the historians that in one case the number of people ordered out upon the plain was so great that it took 4 days for them to pass out and assemble at the appointed place, and that after those who were to be spared had been separated from the rest, the number that were left to be slain was over 100,000, as recorded by the secretaries, who made an enumeration of them. In another case, the slaughter was so great that it took 12 days to count the number of the dead. Some of the atrocities which were perpetrated upon the prisoners were almost too horrible to be described. In one case, a woman, quite advanced in years, begged the Mongols to spare her life, and promised that, if they would do so, she would give them a pearl of great value. They asked her where the pearl was, and she said she had swallowed it. The Mongols then immediately cut her down and ripped her body open with their swords to find the pearl. They found it, and then, encouraged by this success, and thinking it probable that other women might have attempted to hide their jewels in the same way, they proceeded to kill and cut open a great number of women to search for pearls in their bodies, but they found no more. At the siege of a certain city, called Bamiyan, a young grandson of Genghis Khan, wishing to please his grandfather by his daring, approached so near the wall that he was reached by an arrow shot by one of the archers and killed. Genghis Khan was deeply affected by this event, and he showed by the bitterness of his grief that, though he was so utterly heartless and cruel in inflicting these woes upon others, he could feel for himself very acutely when it came to his turn to suffer. As for the mother of the child, she was rendered perfectly furious by his death. She thought of nothing but revenge, and she only waited for the town to be taken in order that she might enjoy it. When, at last, a practicable breach was made, and the soldiers began to pour into the city, she went in with the rest, and insisted that every man, woman, and child should be put to death. Her special rage was directed against the children, whom she seemed to take special pleasure in destroying, in vengeance for the death of her own child. The hatred and rage which she manifested against children extended even to babes unborn, and these feelings she evinced by atrocities too shocking to be described. The opinions which Genghis Khan entertained on religious subjects appear from a conversation which he held at one time during the course of his campaigns in Western Asia with some learned Mohammedan doctors at Bokhara, which was the great seat at that time of science and philosophy. He asked the doctors what were the principles of their religion. They replied that these principles consisted of 5 fundamental points. 1. In believing in one God, the creator of all things, and the supreme ruler and governor of the universe. 2. In giving 1/40th part of their yearly income or gains to the poor. 3. In praying to God 5 times every day. 4. In setting apart 1 month in each year for fasting. 5. In making a pilgrimage to the temple in Mecca, there to worship God. Genghis Khan told them that he believed himself in the first of these articles, and he approved of the 3 succeeding ones. It was very well, he said, to give 1/40th of one's income to the poor, and to pray to God 5 times a day, and to set apart 1 month in the year for a fast. But as to the last article, he could not but dissent from it entirely, for the whole world was God's house, and it was ridiculous, he said, to imagine that one place could really be any more fitting than another as a place for worshipping him. The learned doctors were much dissatisfied with this answer. They were, in fact, more displeased with the dissent which the emperor expressed from this last article, the only one which was purely and wholly ritual in its character, than they were gratified with the concurrence which he expressed in all the other 4. This is not at all surprising, for from the times of the Pharisees down to the present day, the spirit of sectarianism and bigotry in religion always plants itself most strongly on the platform of externals. It is always contending strenuously for rights, while it places comparatively in the background all that bears directly on the vital and spiritual interests of the soul. End of chapter 22.
Imagine a place where raw natural beauty combines with insight, entertainment, and information. Step through that door with me now. This is Radio Lillooet 100.5 FM.
Chapter 23, Grand Celebrations, 1221 to 1224. When Genghis Khan found that his conquests in Western Asia were in some good degree established and confirmed, he illustrated his victory and the consequent extension of his empire by two very imposing celebrations. The first was a grand hunt. The second was a solemn convocation of all the estates of his immense realm in a sort of diet or deliberative assembly. The accounts given by the historians of both these celebrations are doubtless greatly exaggerated. Their description of the hunt is as follows. It was after the close of the campaign in 1221 that it took place, while the army were in winter quarters. The object of the hunt was to keep the soldiers occupied so as to avoid the relaxation of discipline and the vices and disorder which generally creep into a camp where there are no active occupations to engage the minds of the men. The hunt took place in a vast region of uninhabited country, which was infested with wild beasts of every kind. The soldiers were marched out on this expedition in order of war, as if it were a country occupied by armed men that they were going to attack. The different detachments were conducted to the different points in the outskirts of the country, from which they severally extended themselves to the right and left, so as completely to enclose the ground. And the space was so large, it is said, which was thus enclosed, that it took them several weeks to march into the center. It is true that in such a case the men would advance very slowly, perhaps only a few miles each day, in order that they might examine the ground thoroughly, and leave no ravine or thicket or other lurking place where beasts might conceal themselves unexplored. Still, the circle was doubtless immensely large. When the appointed morning at length arrived, the men at the several stations were arrayed, and they commenced their advance toward the center, moving to the sound of trumpets, drums, timbrels, and other such instruments of martial music as were in use in those days. The men were strictly forbidden to kill any animal. They were only to start them out from their lurking places and lairs and drive them in toward the center of the field. Great numbers of the men were provided with picks, spades, and other similar tools with which they were to dig out the burrows and holes of such animals as should seek refuge underground. They went on in this way for some weeks. The animals ran before them, thinking, when they were disturbed by the men, that it was only a momentary danger, which they could easily escape from, as usual, by running forward into the next thicket. But soon the advancing line of the soldiers reached them there, and drove them out again. And if they attempted to turn to the right or the left, they soon found themselves intercepted. Thus, as the circle grew narrower, and the space enclosed diminished, the animals began to find themselves mixing with one another in great numbers, and being now irritated and angry, they attacked one another in many instances, the strong falling upon and killing the weak. Thus a great many were killed, though not by the hands of the soldiers. At last the numbers became so great, and the excitement and terror of the animals so intense, that the soldiers had great difficulty in driving them forward. The poor beasts ran this way and that, half distracted, while the soldiers pressed steadily on behind them, and cut them off from every chance of escape by raising terrific shouts and outcries, and by brandishing weapons before them wherever they attempted to turn. At length the animals were all driven into the inner circle, a comparatively small space, which had been previously marked out. Around this space double and triple lines of troops were drawn up, armed with pikes and spears, which they pointed in towards the center, thus forming a sort of wall by which the beasts were closely shut in. The plan was now for the officers and khans, and all the great personages of the court and the army, to go into the circle and show their courage and their prowess by attacking the beasts and slaying them. But the courage required for such an exploit was not so great as it might seem, for it was always found on these occasions that the beasts, though they had been very wild and ferocious when first aroused from their lairs, and had appeared excessively irritated when they found the circle beginning to narrow around them, ended at last in losing all their spirit, and in becoming discouraged, dejected, and tame. This was owing partly, perhaps, to their having become, in some degree, familiar with the sight of men, but more probably to the exhaustion produced by long-continued fatigue and excitement, and to their having been for so many days deprived in a great degree of their accustomed food and rest. Thus in this, as in a great many other similar instances, the poor soldiers and common people incurred the danger and the toil, and then the great men came in at the end to reap the glory. Genghis Khan himself was the first to enter the circle for the purpose of attacking the beasts. He was followed by the princes of his family, and by other great chieftains and khans. As they went in, the whole army surrounded the enclosure and completely filled the air with the sound of drums, timbrels, trumpets, and other such instruments, and with the noise of the most terrific shouts and outcries which they could make, in order to terrify and overawe the beasts as much as possible, and to destroy in them all thought and hope of resistance. And indeed, so much effect was produced by these means of intimidation that the beasts, it is said, became completely stupefied. They were so affrighted that they lost all their fierceness. The lions and tigers became as tame as lambs, and the bears and wild boars, like the most timorous creatures, became dejected and amazed. Still, the going in of Genghis Khan and the princes to attack them was not wholly without danger, for, of course, it was a point of honor with them to select the most ferocious and fierce of the animals, and some of these, when they found themselves actually assailed, were aroused again, and recovering in some degree their native ferocity, seemed impelled to make a last desperate effort to defend themselves. After killing a few of the lions, tigers, and bears, Genghis Khan and his immediate suite returned to a place at one side of the enclosure, where a throne had been set up for the emperor on an eminence, which afforded a good view of the field. Here Genghis Khan took his seat, in order to enjoy the spectacle of the slaughter, and then an immense number of men were allowed to go in and amuse themselves with killing and destroying the poor beasts till they were perfectly satiated with the sight of blood and of suffering. At last some of the Khan's grandsons, attended by several other young princes, approached the throne where the emperor was seated, and petitioned him to order the carnage to cease, and to allow the rest of the animals to go free. This petition the emperor granted. The lines were broken up. The animals that had escaped being massacred made their way back into the wilds again, and the hunt was over. The several detachments of the army then set out on their march back to the camp again, but so great was the scale on which this grand hunting expedition was conducted that 4 months elapsed between the time of their setting out upon it till the time of their return. The Grand Diet, or General Assembly of the States of Genghis Khan's Empire, took place 2 or 3 years later, when the conquest of Western Asia was complete, and the sons of the emperor and all the great generals could be called together at the emperor's headquarters without much danger. The place chosen for this assembly was a vast plain in the vicinity of the city of Tukat, which has already been mentioned as one of the great cities conquered by Genghis Khan. Tukat lay in a central and convenient position for the purpose of this assembly. It was, moreover, a rich and beautiful city, and could furnish all that would be necessary for the wants of the assembly. The meeting, however, was not to be held in the city itself, but upon a great plain in the environs of it, where there was space for all the khans, with their numerous retinues, to pitch their tents. When the khans and chieftains began to assemble, there came first the sons of the king, returning from the various expeditions on which their father had sent them, and bringing with them magnificent presents. These presents, of course, consisted of the treasures and other valuables which they had taken in plunder from the various cities which had fallen into their hands. The presents which Jughi brought exceeded in value those of all the others. Among the rest, there was a herd of horses, 100,000 in number. These horses had, of course, been seized in the pastures of the conquered countries, and were now brought to the emperor to be used by him in mounting his troops. They were arrayed in bands according to the color, white, dappled gray, bay, black, and spotted, of each kind an equal number. The emperor received and welcomed his sons with great joy, and readily accepted their presents. In return, he made presents to them from his own treasuries. After this, as other princes and khans came in and encamped with their troops and followers on the plain, the emperor entertained them all with a series of grand banquets and public diversions of all sorts. Among other things, a grand hunting party was organized, somewhat similar in the general plan to the one already described, only on a much smaller scale, of course, in respect to the number of persons engaged and the time occupied, while yet it greatly surpassed that one in magnificence and splendor. Several thousand beasts were slain, it is said, and a great number and variety of birds, which were taken by the falcons. At the end of the hunt, a great banquet was given, which surpassed all the other feasts in munificence. They had on the tables of this banquet a great variety of drinks, not only rich wines from the southern countries, but beer and metheglin, and also sherbet, which the army had learned to make in Persia. In the meantime, the great space on the plain, which had been set apart for the encampment, had been gradually becoming filled up by the arrival of the khans, until at length, in every direction, as far as the eye could reach, the whole plain was covered with groups of tents and long lines of movable houses brought on wheels. The ground which the encampment covered was said by the historians to have been 7 leagues in extent. If the space occupied was anything at all approaching this magnitude, it could only be that the outer portions of it were occupied by the herdsmen and other servants of the khans, who had to take care of the cattle and horses of the troops, and to provide them with suitable pasture. Indeed, the great number of animals which these wandering tribes always took with them on their journeys rendered it necessary to appropriate a much larger space to their encampments than would have been otherwise required. It is surprising to us, who are accustomed to look upon living in tents as so exclusively an irregular and temporary expedient, to learn how completely this mode of life was reduced to a system in those days, and how perfect and complete all the arrangements relating to it were made. In this case, in the center of the encampment, a space of 2 leagues in length was regularly laid out in streets, squares, and marketplaces, like a town. Here were the emperor's quarters, with magnificent tents for himself and his immediate household, and multitudes of others of a plainer character for his servants and retainers. The tents of the other grand khans were near. They were made of rich materials, and ornamented in a sumptuous manner, and silken streamers of various colors floated in the wind from the summits of them. Besides these, there was an immense tent built for the assembly itself to hold its sessions in. This tent was so large, it is said, that it would contain 2,000 persons. It was covered with white, which made it very conspicuous. There were 2 entrance gates leading to the interior. One of them was called the Imperial Gate, and was for the use of Genghis Khan alone. The other was the Public Gate, and was used in general for the members of the assembly and for spectators. Within the tent was erected a magnificent throne, intended for the use of the emperor during the sessions of the assembly. A great amount of important business was transacted by the assembly while it continued in session, and many important edicts were made by the emperor. The constitution and laws of the empire were promulgated anew, and all necessary arrangements made for the government of the various provinces, both near and remote. At length, when these various objects had been accomplished and the business was concluded, the emperor gave audience individually to all the princes, khans, generals, governors of provinces, and other grand dignitaries who were present on the occasion, in order that they might take their leave preparatory to returning to their several countries. When this ceremony was concluded, the encampment was broken up, and the various khans set off, each at the head of his own caravan, on the road leading to his own home. End of chapter 23. Chapter 24. Conclusion. 1227. After the grand convocation described in the last chapter, Genghis Khan lived only 3 years. During this time, he went on extending his conquests with the same triumphant success that had attended his previous operations. Having at length established his dominion in Western Asia on a permanent basis, he returned to the original seat of his empire in the East after 7 years' absence, where he was received with great honor by the Mongol nation. He began again to extend his conquests in China. He was very successful. Indeed, with the exception of one great calamity which befell him, his career was one of continued and unexampled prosperity. The calamity was the death of his son Juki, his oldest, most distinguished, and best beloved son. The news of this event threw the Khan into a deep melancholy, so that for a time he lost all his interest in public affairs, and even the news of victories obtained in distant countries by his armies ceased to awaken any joyful emotions in his mind. The Khan was now, too, becoming quite advanced in life, being about 64 years old, which is an age at which the mind is slow to recover its lost elasticity. He did, however, slowly recover from the effects of his grief, and he then went on with his warlike preparations. He had conquered all the northern portion of China, and was now making arrangements for a grand invasion of the southern part, when at length, in the spring of the year 1227, he fell sick. He struggled against the disease during the summer, but at length in August he found himself growing worse, and he felt that his end was drawing nigh. His mind was occupied mainly, during all this interval, by arranging the details of the coming campaign, and making known to the officers around him all the particulars of his plans, in order that they might carry them out successfully after his decease. He was chiefly concerned, as well he might be, lest the generals should quarrel among each other after he should be gone, and he continually exhorted them to be united, and on no account to allow discord or dissensions to creep in and divide them. His oldest son, next to Juki, was Jagatay, but he was of a mild and amiable temper, and not so well qualified to govern so widely extended an empire as the next son, whose name was Oktay. The next son to Oktay, whose name was Toli, was with his father at the time when his sickness at last assumed an immediately alarming character. This change for the worse, which convinced the emperor that his death was drawing nigh, took place one day when he was traveling with a portion of his army, being borne on a litter on account of his infirm and feeble condition. A halt was ordered, a camp was formed, and the great conqueror was borne to a tent, which was pitched for him on the spot near the borders of the forest. The physicians and the astrologers came around him and tried to comfort him with encouraging predictions, but he knew by the pains that he felt and by other inward sensations that his hour had come. He accordingly ordered that all of his sons who were in the camp and all the princes of his family should be called in to his bedside. When they had all assembled, he caused himself to be raised up in his bed, and then made a short but very solemn address to them. "I leave you," said he, "the greatest empire in the world, but your preserving it depends upon your remaining always united. If discord steals in among you, all will most assuredly be lost." Then, turning to the great chieftains and khans who were standing by, the great nobles of his court, he appealed to them, as well as to the princes of his family, whether it was not just and reasonable that he, who had established the empire and built it up wholly from the very foundations, should have the right to name a successor to inherit it after he was gone. They all expressed a full assent to this proposition. His sons and the other princes of his family fell on their knees and said, "You are our father and our emperor, and we are your slaves. It is for us to bow in submission to all the commands with which you honor us, and to render the most implicit obedience to them." The Khan then proceeded to announce to the assembly that he had made choice of his son Oktay as his successor. And he declared him the Khan of Khans, which was the imperial title, according to the constitution. The whole assembly then kneeled again, and solemnly declared that they accepted the choice which the emperor had made, and promised allegiance and fidelity to the new sovereign so soon as he should be invested with power. The aged emperor then gave to his second son, Jagatay, a large country for his kingdom, which, however, he was, of course, to hold under the general sovereignty of his brother. He also appointed his son Tole, who was then present, to act as regent until Oktay should return. The assembly was then dismissed, and very soon afterward the great conqueror died. Tole, of course, immediately entered upon his office as regent, and under his direction the body of his father was interred, with great magnificence, under a venerable tree, where the Khan had rested himself with great satisfaction a few days before he was taken sick. The spot was a very beautiful one, and in due time a magnificent monument was erected over the grave. Trees were afterward planted around the spot, and other improvements were made in the grounds, by which it became at length, it was said, one of the finest sepulchres in the world. As soon as Oktay, whom the emperor had designated as his successor, returned home, he was at once proclaimed emperor, and established himself at his father's court. The news of the old emperor's death rapidly spread throughout Asia, and a succession of ambassadors were sent from all the provinces, principalities, and kingdoms throughout the empire, and also from such contiguous states as desired to maintain friendly relations with the new monarch, to bring addresses and messages of condolence from their respective rulers. And so great was the extent of country from which these ambassadors came, that a period of 6 months was consumed before these melancholy ceremonies were ended. The fate of the grand empire which Genghis Khan established was the same with that of all others that have arisen in the world from time to time, by the extension of the power of great military commanders over widely separated and heterogeneous nations. The sons and successors to whom the vast possessions descended soon quarreled among themselves, and the immense fabric fell to pieces in less time than it had taken to construct it. End of chapter 24. End of The History of Genghis Khan by Jacob Abbott.
Ladies and gentlemen, join us again next week for another Radio Lillooet special presentation.